Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Colorectal cancer rates in adults over the age of 50 have been falling dramatically since the mid-1980s. The decline is thanks in large part to better screening. A recent study published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute has found some bad news, too, that rates of colon and rectal cancer are rising sharply among millennials and Generation Xers. Sonia Kupfer is co-director of the Comprehensive Cancer Risk and Prevention Clinic and a gastroenterologist at the University of Chicago Medicine. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kupfer.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with the colon. What does it do and why do we need it?
So the colon is really an organ that is responsible for packaging our waste and then sort of holding on to it until we're at a point where we can get rid of it. It really is responsible for taking out some of the excess water, but there are conditions in which people need to have their colon removed or parts of it removed, and they do quite well.
Are colorectal cancer and colon cancer the same thing, or what's the distinction?
Sure. So colorectal cancer merely refers to cancers that involve both the colon and the rectum. So the rectum refers to the very last part of our large intestine, and that's the area that's responsible for holding on to our stool until we're able to get rid of it. So when we talk about colorectal cancer, we're talking about both the rectum, the very last part, as well as the whole rest of the large intestine, which is referred to as the colon.
What causes cancers in the colon and the rectum? What is there a particular thing or what?
Sure. So it's kind of the million-dollar question.
Okay.
I think there are a lot of theories about what might contribute to colorectal cancer. So, for example, the World Health Organization has identified processed meat and red meat as being a risk factor for colorectal cancer. We believe that Western diet in general, which is higher in fats and lower in fiber, is probably a contributing factor. Obesity may play a role as well. Not getting physical exercise, smoking, excessive alcohol use. And then the other thing is genetic factors. So there are hereditary cancer syndromes that increase risk dramatically for colon and rectal cancer.
Typically, it's older adults who are diagnosed, and that may be affected by the fact that they're screened more typically. Why are there any theories out there about why this increase in younger populations?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think the recent study that was published on these increasing rates really does not give us direct answers. We can hypothesize as to why there might be an increase. So, for example, you're right that we recommend universal screening of all individuals who we consider at average risk for colorectal cancer to begin their screening at age 50. And so, you know, that's when we're starting to detect cancers. It's possible that because of more accessibility of colonoscopy, for example, that younger individuals are just being diagnosed with cancers mm-hmm. because they're getting these procedures for other reasons. But I don't think that's the whole answer of what's going on. People have invoked the rising obesity trend, although that's not we can't prove causality mm-hmm. there either. Some people have thought, could this be other factors? Are there other ways in which cancers develop in younger individuals? And I mentioned that hereditary factors also play a role, and it's certainly not explaining the rise in young onset colorectal cancer, but is really something that all people should be aware of. When you have someone with a colon cancer in their 20s, that a family history should be obtained to determine whether perhaps this is something that they've inherited that's increased their risk for colorectal cancer.
Have they identified a gene?
Absolutely. So there are a number of syndromes that increase risk of colorectal cancer, and There are two ways to think about it. One are syndromes that cause people to develop a lot of the precursors to colorectal cancer, which are polyps. And so people can get many, many polyps throughout their colon. And their risk of developing colorectal cancer over their lifetime can be up to 100%. There's another syndrome, which is the most common syndrome, which is known as Lynch syndrome. That's due to hereditary factors in five different genes, and that leads also to younger onset colon and rectal cancer. And those individuals, when we identify them, they're coming back for colonoscopies on a yearly basis because their risk can be up to 80% in their lifetime of developing colorectal cancer.
Is it hard to identify them?
It requires individuals, medical providers, to ask a family history, which as our visits are getting shorter and shorter, mm-hmm. people don't take the time to ask about family history. We do also have universal screening of colorectal tumors, which is now advocated, where we can look for markers of hereditary syndromes, such as Lynch syndrome. And so we have a number of ways to identify these individuals, but we think the vast majority are not being diagnosed. And the actual prevalence of this condition is now estimated to be somewhere between 1 in 270 and 1 in 280 individuals. So not as rare as we previously thought.
Does the fact that more people were insured the past several years have anything to do with that? In other words, they were just getting regular wellness appointments with doctors and it was being discussed.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if that were really the full explanation. I'm not sure that it is, and mm-hmm. it's hard to prove that. Obviously, having access to health care, having health insurance, allows individuals to have access to screening tests, mm-hmm. and that's a great thing. I just want to note that we're talking about younger onset colon cancer because of the study that came out, but mm-hmm. it's still true that the largest risk is in those over the age of 50. So individuals who are over 50 and have not gotten colorectal cancer screening, there's a number of different ways that can be done, including by colonoscopy, but also by stool examinations for blood, that those individuals really should make sure they're getting their screening test. I think an open question now is whether the age of screening should be lowered into the 40s. And we're not quite there yet, but I think, certainly identification of individuals who we know may be at higher risk, and then also evaluation of symptoms for those under the age of 50. So anybody who presents with rectal bleeding or symptoms that are over time not improving should absolutely speak with their doctor and inquire as to whether further evaluation is required.
I read about a young woman in her 20s who presented with the rectal bleeding, blood in her stool and so forth. But because of her age, her physician said it's probably just hemorrhoids or whatever. I mean, are doctors being better educated about what the signs are as well?
Yeah, we're certainly working on that for those of us working in the colon cancer awareness arena. Mm-hmm. This is something that we have been talking about for at least the last 3 to 5 years about this rising trend, and certainly are advocating for earlier investigation for potential colorectal cancer. Although overall, the numbers are still smaller than mm-hmm. the individuals who are developing colorectal cancer over the age of 50. But I think ongoing symptoms that, warrant further evaluation, we definitely should not waste time and should investigate those.
Overall, are there disparities, gender-related disparities, racial or ethnic-related disparities?
That's a great question, and there absolutely are. So we know from national cancer statistics that African Americans, both men and women, have the highest rates of both colorectal cancer incidence, so getting colorectal cancer, but also dying from colorectal cancer. And there are a lot of reasons why that is the case, and we're all working very hard to try and reduce those disparities. I think there's absolutely no reason in 2017 why there should be differences between races in terms of colorectal cancer, given that it is such a preventable disease. In terms of gender disparities, men and women have equal rates over their lifetime of getting colorectal cancer. So men and women should get their screening if they are at average risk starting at age 50.
How treatable is colorectal cancer? You just said that it is treatable. How is it treated? What do you do?
Absolutely. So the most important thing for treating colorectal cancer in terms of outcomes is catching it early. So when I talk about preventing the disease, I'm talking about actually finding precancerous polyps, in this case, removing them and reducing really the chance of ever getting colorectal cancer in someone's lifetime. That's our real goal. However, even if we identify colorectal cancer in an early stage, so in a stage where it has not spread to lymph nodes or more distant organs, the survival for the next 5 years is quite good. It's over 90%. As people start to have stages that are more advanced, where the cancer has had a chance to grow further into the bowel wall, it's involving lymph nodes or the liver, for example, the five-year survival rates really decrease at that point. And so our main goal is to try and identify people before they ever go on to develop cancer. But certainly if we do identify them, we'd like to get them at a very early stage when surgery may be the only treatment they need.
Now, when they remove polyps during colonoscopies, they, you know, when I had them removed before, you know, they're like, they're nothing to worry about. Well, we do it just to be on the safe side. Polyps can turn into cancer.
Yeah, so polyps are the precursor of colon cancer. What we try to do is identify those polyps by a colonoscopy, for example, and remove them using different kinds of instruments during the colonoscopy. And I'll just say that this is not something that a patient will feel.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, you're under most circumstances, you're under sedation and you won't know any differently in terms of.
You just take their word for it after it's over.
Exactly. And then what happens is a pathologist, someone who looks at the specimen, the polyp under a microscope, will provide the gastroenterologist who performed the colonoscopy with some indication as to what type of polyp it was. There's sort of many different flavors of polyps, and there are certain ones that we think would go on to develop cancer in some cases, mm-hmm. and others that are completely benign. But it's important to remove them and identify that, and that helps us to determine when you should come back. So are you someone that has to come back in 3 years, 5 years, or if you have no polyps, right now, for an average risk individual, the time to come back is in 10 years.
Would you like to see that increase or in frequency?
No, I think right now these are our guidelines are based on what we understand from studies that have looked over long periods of time in terms of what the risk is of developing new polyps over that time. And for someone who is at average risk, so when I talk about average risk, these are people who are over the age of 50 but don't have a family history and of colon cancer or colon polyps, certain colon polyps, or individuals who don't have a certain inflammatory condition known as inflammatory bowel disease, which also is an increased risk factor. So those at average risk, if no polyp is found based on long-term studies, we know the risk of developing another polyp is small over a 10-year period. And so that's where that interval comes from. So I don't think there's a reason to change that.
Uh-huh.
Based on the studies that we have, I think where the question is now arising is, should we lower the age?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure right now we have the evidence completely to support that. There have been, I mentioned the disparities among African Americans. There have been some individuals and organizations that have called for earlier screening in that population starting around the age of 45.
And just to be clear, when you get a colonoscopy, are they also looking at the rectum?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the rectum is the first place that we look.
Yep.
As we're going in, and we get a very good evaluation of that when we're coming back through the colon. We blow air to kind of open it up so we can see all the walls. And the important thing there is that a gastroenterologist takes enough time coming back, looking at all areas of the colon, that the bowel preparation, the laxative preparation that was done before was done completely, so we can really see everything. And that we evaluate thoroughly for polyps.
Dr. Sonia Kupfer, thanks for so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
No problem. Thank you. And I just wanted to say that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month.
I didn't know that.
And so this comes at a very good time and really is a time for us as a community to remind everyone to get your screening and tell all your friends to get their screening.
All right. That's Dr. Sonia Kupfer. She is a gastroenterologist at the University of Chicago Medicine. We will continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Despite all of the Wellness Wednesday shows in the world, we're all going to die someday. Most people avoid talking about or planning ahead for that inevitability, and that's an issue for doctors, patients, and their families, according to Jessica Zitter. She is a critical and palliative care physician in Oakland, California, and author of a new book on end-of-life decisions. The book is entitled Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Dr. Zitter joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What inspires you to write a book on end-of-life medical decisions?
Well, in my work, I feel like I have a front-row seat to a lot of unnecessary suffering that I hadn't expected to see when I first entered medicine. And I feel like I need to tell people about it because there's a lot that we can do about it.
Tell us about your front-row seat.
Well, I'm an ICU doctor, and so I work in, you know, the most intensive of locations. When people get really, really sick, they end up eventually coming there. And a lot of times what we do is use a lot of machines to keep, you know, substitute for organ function, so people get attached progressively to machines. And in something that I call the end-of-life conveyor belt, because although those machines can, you know, work miracles for some people, and obviously that's why I went into critical care in the first place, is to save lives, you know, for other people, like the seriously ill, the terminally ill, the frail, it can actually cause tremendous suffering. And I see it every day.
Where does the title of the book, Extreme Measures, come from?
Well, it's sort of a double entendre. You know, extreme measures sort of at first sounds like a heroic doctor rushing into, you know, save lives with machines. It's sort of how our vision of those types of extreme measures is. But extreme also has a sort of a negative connotation, that things that are extreme can be too much. And so it's a sort of double-edged sword of what extreme can mean. And also a third meaning is really that the other solution that I advocate for, which is intense communication and collaboration with patients and families and other healthcare professionals instead of this sort of hierarchical default decision-making and, you know, pursuing life prolongation at all costs, that also requires a lot of intensive energy and extreme attention, which is a different kind of extreme work than the original meaning.
Who did you write this book for?
Well, I wrote this book for everybody. I think that we as a culture have sort of been death denying. And I think, you know, we've done this since the age of the Greek myths. We've had these fantasies of perpetual life. But mm-hmm. I think that now, in the past 100 years, we have this sort of the technology to enact and to chase that fantasy. And so I think we're all doing it. I think, you know, patients and families are hoping for this miracle cure. I think doctors and other healthcare professionals are turning away from what's becoming more and more difficult about death as we become less comfortable with it. And I think we're all suffering from it. I think that this is really a book for everybody, anybody who will die, anyone who will care for someone who will die, and anyone who will, you know, a family person who will watch a loved one die, or a doctor or a nurse who will manage their care in the hospital or other location.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Jessica Zitter. She's author of a new book. It's entitled Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Zitter, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you've said that you've witnessed a profound benefit of the high-tech tools we have now to save lives in the ICU where you work, but you've also witnessed the profound suffering that those tools can inflict on patients who are approaching the end of life. And I'm wondering, are doctors educated? Are they trained on how to balance that? Is this a discussion you're having, they're having in medical schools, for instance, or continuing education?
It's honestly just starting over the past few years.
I've been having shows on this for years now, this very topic. And I'm wondering, have they started talking about it where you work? Yeah?
You're ahead of the curve, honestly. You know, it's coming into medical schools. I'm watching it. I'm watching it come into our residency program at our hospital. And I'm feeling encouraged. I think it's once, you know, the first step is to acknowledge the problem. And I think that's starting to happen. You know, obviously we're seeing it in the popular press. We're seeing it in the in the newspapers, and we're seeing it on your show. You've been doing this for a while. And we're starting to see it also in medical schools and residency programs. But that's one step.
Mm-hmm.
To acknowledge the problem. The second point, the second step is to really start to change behaviors. And particularly when it comes to moments of extremis or extremes, illness or physiologic crisis, as you see particularly in the intensive care unit, a lot of that knowledge and understanding can go out the window, and we default to these behaviors of, well, let's just keep treating. And so, we've got a long way to go.
You've written that often your patients aren't even aware that they are dying. Can you talk about what you mean by that and why that is? Is it because the doctors aren't being upfront with them or what?
Yeah, I work with so many doctors, and I also consider myself, all of us, to be caring and compassionate people. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's a tough job, and I think we all go in there to do well and do right by our patients. What I think is happening is that breaking bad news, having difficult communication and conversations in general about anything, is difficult. And when you have an out, from it, one that's sanctioned actually by the profession, I mean, it's really, we are taught to keep treating, keep pushing. Our billing sheets, it's not even about the money. It's about the sense of checking off. Oh, I did this today. I did that catheter. I did this intubation. We don't even, it's just very, very new that we've even started being able to say, oh, I did this end of life conversation and put that on our billing sheet. And again, I'm not talking about it as a money mm-hmm. compensation issue. I'm talking about it just as a sense of value and what's a worthwhile activity. So, I really think that we've got to start to value those types of activities differently and more. And actually, we're currently at risk. Representative Steve King from, I believe it's Iowa, has put out a bill to end compensation for physicians having end-of-life conversations with patients, which just started at the beginning of 2016. And he's now saying that he thinks that's dangerous for patients. And I want to just say very loudly and clearly that it's teaching, it's incentivizing, encouraging physicians to be honest about this news, to break through the difficulty of having a difficult conversation, to learn the skills to have these kinds of conversations. That's what's going to save people by letting them have control of their lives instead of just being bewildered by what's going on and saying, oh, my physician wants to do this, so it must be the right thing.
I don't know about Steve King, but people and what's inspiring that, it may be this continuing backlash to that fable about the death panels and all that junk from back when the Affordable Care Act was being debated. But some people are afraid that it is a slippery slope, that once we normalize in the way that you're talking about, that we start to devalue life.
Well, I would like to tell them about all of the data that's out there mm-hmm. that shows a profoundly compelling story that when patients are educated and know what's happening, when they are when they are able to avail themselves of conversations with their physicians to really get to the truth of what's going on with them prognostically, that they tend to, number one, choose significantly lower amounts of technology for those, again, who are approaching the end of life. And they, number two, do not live any shorter.
And who are informed about that.
Right. So information about true, honest prognosis decreases the amount of technology that we're using. People choose less technology, and they don't live any shorter. So that's a really important statistic for people to know. In fact, there's several studies that show patients living longer who, for example, there's a couple of studies, one with metastatic colon cancer, one with metastatic lung cancer, that show patients living, you know, 2 to 3 months longer when they choose, when they say, I'm not doing any more disease-focused treatment like chemotherapy, I'm now going to do palliative care, and those patients are living longer. So that's a myth. That's a myth that it shortens or hastens death.
What does the research show us about the fear of death and our tendency to ignore it, and how that affects the end of life?
Well,
versus, I mean, you made the point that if you accept it and stop with the extreme treatments, you actually can live longer. But what about the fears and the ignorance?
You know, there's a lot of data in sociology and psychology literature in general about fear of death. And, you know, there is scary. I'm sorry?
It's scary.
It's scary. It is scary. It's you know, we're human beings in our... Our whole DNA is wanting us to keep living forever. That's what everything, all, you know, most of our activities are towards trying to procreate and keep ourselves alive. And it's an understandable thing. But I think for most of us, if we sit and think about it and understand that, well, we are, you know, we know we're going to die cognitively. And if we can sort of accept and confront that reality, there's a certain peace that comes with that. And then the preparation that follows allows us to have that control that is really empowering and that can actually bring a lot of peace and comfort to people.
How much does this affect patients' families?
Very much. And this is something that's very important to point out. Do you know that the exact statistic, I'm forgetting, but it's around 30% of families with seriously ill patients go bankrupt, seriously ill family members. There is a profound amount, it's called caregiver burden. It's the burden of the family members caring for these patients. They take off work. They have, you know, these patients are very debilitated a lot of times, and there's a profound amount of both financial and emotional distress that comes with the care of a very seriously ill patient whose life is being prolonged on machines or in other ways. And this is a really serious problem for our society, and I think that the suffering that caregiver is something we're starting to pay attention to and realize, oh my goodness, we need to give more support to those family caregivers, but we really have a serious problem of suffering. I will tell you, when I am the ICU attending and I have a patient who comes in, and they're on a machine now, something happened acutely, and you know they may have been sick for months or years, but all of a sudden they're in respiratory failure or cardiac failure, and they're on machines. People are standing around the bedside. This happens all the time, and I say, okay, let's talk about this. Do we keep the attachment to the machines here? Do we form a permanent connection using a trach or a feeding tube and send the person to a ventilator facility? Or do you think that this person would want to be able to die naturally? And I can't tell you how many families say, we never talked about this. I don't know what to do. And the default in a situation like that is just to say, well, let's continue on treatment. But we know from survey data that most people wouldn't want to live attached to machines. And so we have this massive discrepancy and profound suffering of the loving family members at the bedside.
So that's the issue of having the discussion.
Yes. I mean, I think it all, ultimately, the solution here is honest communication and collaboration, communication within family, within families years before people start to get sick, so that there's this robust understanding of who this patient is and an ability to speak for them when they are no longer able to speak for themselves. And then another level of communication, again, between the family, patient and family, and the healthcare team, so that there's this honesty that we're hiding behind this elephant in the room right now, and we need to be able to come out from there and do differently.
And that doing all of that kind of planning and having those kind of discussions helps as well when it comes to disagreement within a family then.
It does. I mean, I think, you know, it just goes without saying that for the most, obviously there's always exceptions, but for the most part, when families have sort of prepared and rehearsed for this moment, thought about it, there's just less that can go wrong. There's less disagreement. There's just more certainty about how things are going to proceed and more agreement amongst family members.
You're teaching a class called Death Ed at your daughter's high school, and it seems young to start talking about death in some people's opinion. What's the magic about that time?
Well, it's kind of funny. It's not funny, but that was the only opportunity. I had wanted to do it with higher level high school students. I thought, you know, starting in grade 12 would probably be better, but this was an opportunity that just came along because there was a big challenge grant by the IDEO design firm, and my friend and I, Dr. Don Gross, who's a palliative care doctor, submitted this idea to do death ed. Both of us had taught sex ed to our kids' classes, and we thought, you know, this is no more of a taboo, and it's just as important, if not more, to be able to understand this important topic. And we presented it. We won a top idea from IDEO, and so then we just were propelled forward, and I asked my daughter's school if they would be interested, and they said, well, we can give you 2 hours, but it's during our ninth grade health class. And I thought, And we both have ninth graders, my friend and I, and we both have spent many hours talking to our kids about death and to their friends who happen to come in and out of the house. And they never run away screaming. And we thought, let's try it. And it was an amazing experience. These kids were very receptive and very willing to talk, and they learned a lot, and it was, you know, they were eager to take home what their conversations to their families.
And I assume no pushback from the families.
None. You know, we're in California. It's a very progressive place. It's a very progressive school, but none. And a lot of interest from around the country, just from all locations in the country of other high schools saying, oh, this is something we'd like to do. So I think that people are interested.
Did the kids ask any questions that surprised you?
There were a few things that really surprised me. I think the one that really sticks out the most was that these kids, there was such a high level of concern about their families. We taught them how to play a game called Go Wish, which I highly recommend for people who are trying to get into this conversation with their own families. It's a card game, and it helps you layer out and prioritize among 36 cards and priorities about how you want to live, which ones are the most important to you, which ones are the least important to you. And so many of these children, teenagers, said they didn't want to be a burden to their families. And it was so interesting because you sort of think of teenagers as being very self-oriented. And
just say
kids,
selfish. Go ahead.
Right. It was really striking to me how many of them said that.
That is interesting. Well, Dr. Jessica Zitter, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, so such a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Jessica Zitter is the author of a new book. It's entitled Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This week, House Republican leadership revealed their plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. It's been less than 2 days since the proposal was revealed, but already other GOP members in Congress are casting doubt, arguing the draft is nothing more than Obamacare lite. For more information on the proposal, visit readthebill.gop.gov. Okay, readthebill.gop. Joining us now to discuss that and other health news is chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Based on what we know so far, and if the plan were to become law, what can people expect for their health insurance premiums?
Well, it depends who you are, but I think for an awful lot of people, it's clear that the health premiums are going to go up. And up to an extent that I think a lot of people who had insurance under the Affordable Care Act will not be able to afford it.
Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government provides tax credits to help some people pay deductibles and co-payments. But under the proposal released this week in Congress, that so-called cost sharing subsidy would go away in 2020. How does that affect costs?
Well, we did it sort of a back of the envelope calculation on that, and tried to use really conservative numbers. But if you're for example, a 60-year-old person, and your income is $45,000 a year, so a modest income, under the current Affordable Care Act, you would pay a cap at around $4,300, no more than that, even though the policy itself would probably cost around $12,000.
Mm-hmm.
With the proposed plans, you won't that cap won't exist. Instead, you'll get a tax credit, and that credit depends upon your income. So it for that 60-year-old person making $45,000 a year, they would get the maximum credit, and that would be $4,000. So it would be less than the $4,700 I just mentioned. But the other thing that happens is that $12,000 plan would go up to around $14,000, $14,500. And that's because currently the law states that the maximum you can charge an older person over a younger person is 3-to-1. So you can't charge an older person more than three times what you would charge a younger person for the same insurance. Under the new plan, it goes to 5-to-1, which means that it's going to go up a lot more. So to use that example again, we're talking about roughly about a $7,000 to $8,000 difference in what a 60-year-old person making $45,000 a year is going to have to pay. That's going to mean that a lot of people aren't going to be able to afford insurance. And that's going to mean we're back to where we were before. And where we were before means that people without insurance aren't going to get a lot of the care they need, especially preventative care. So they'll wind up in the emergency rooms. And somebody's got to pay for the emergency rooms, and that's us. So this is just a redistribution of money away from people getting insurance to other people making money.
The proposed legislation or the draft legislation, although I guess they're going to vote on it in committee this week. Anyways, the proposed legislation replaces the individual mandate the requirement that you have to have insurance with a continuous coverage requirement. Are those apples and oranges? Is there a parallel there? What's the contrast and comparison?
Well, it is really apples and oranges. It's a very different situation. The interesting thing about the everything we're reading about the Affordable Care Act is I find it, and I'm pretty familiar with all of this, and I find it really hard to read and continue to focus on because there's so many details here. Mm-hmm. And I think people are going to get lost in details, just like the question you asked. Last night I had dinner with an executive from a really large insurance company, health insurance company, and they consider these new proposals to be an absolute disaster for not only for the insurance companies, but for the population.
What does it mean to have a continuous coverage requirement?
Well, what it means is that people will actually, and I can't tell you exactly what that means because I've heard so many things and read so many things about what people are talking about in regards to that it's really unclear in my mind at this point what that means.
Okay.
So I really can't help your listeners with that one.
Any sense about the benefits of the Medicaid expansion in states like Ohio? I think there were, 31 states that took advantage of that. Has anything popped up in the evidence that this has been a good thing or it hasn't really made that much difference?
Yeah, I think all the analyses by very neutral parties have shown that certainly by 2020, a lot of people who are getting their insurance through Medicaid are not going to be able to afford it. Let me give you one specific example. It's one of these little details I was talking about. Medicaid has a limit, an income limit. So if you're below that income level, you can get Medicaid. But a lot of people who are right around that limit level one year they may make more than that, and so they won't be candidates or they won't qualify for Medicaid, and they'll lose Medicaid. This new law is going to preclude them going back and getting Medicaid, even if their income drops again. So what we're going to see in, for example, where I understand it best in California, we're going to see a lot of people who were on what we call Medi-Cal, which is Medicaid, who were on it, who are no longer going to be on it. And, you know, I lived through a long period as a practicing physician where I saw what that meant. And I'm going to go back to what I was saying before.
Uh-huh.
What it means is people aren't going to get preventative care, and they're going to wind up with acute problems that could have been prevented. And those acute problems are going to have to be dealt with in the emergency room, which is suboptimal for the patient, the person, and it costs a lot more. So this is all just a shell game in terms of redistributing money.
Let's turn to something that a lot of people know more about, fast casual restaurants. You recently wrote in the Wellness Letter about fast casual restaurant scene and how it's impacting our health. What do we mean by fast casual?
Well, they're like places like Panera and Chipotle, True Food Kitchen, so on. It's an interesting idea. It's the idea that you can get your meal fast, just like a fast food place like McDonald's, but the setting is much nicer. The quality of food and the preparation is much better. Frequently, the food's prepared on the premises. Usually, these places tout the idea that it's local sourced, organic, fresh, and so on. So it's a much nicer environment. It's more expensive, of course, to have that. So typically, we looked at the data on that, and typically, these fast casual food restaurants cost around $9 to $13 for a meal as opposed to like $5 for a meal from a fast food restaurant. So there's a difference in cost.
How is the rise in fast casual restaurants affected fast food? I can see, you know, you can just look at the menus and see that they're getting healthier.
Right. Well, you know, it cuts both ways. We looked at the menus and clearly you can get a much healthier meal from these fast casual food places than you can from the fast food places. There's no question about that. But you really have to be careful. For example, you could order a very healthy meal, maximum of 600 calories. It would have lots of nutrients, fibers, fresh, and so on. Be great. It wouldn't be terribly expensive. On the other hand, we looked at Chipotle, and we looked at their fully loaded burrito, and that's 1,400 calories. Mm-hmm. And if you got some guacamole and chips with it and so on, you're adding on another 600 calories. So you, with that one meal, you're at probably what you should be eating for the day.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful what you order no matter where you are. The other thing we looked at was that they use a lot of salt. Whether it's fast food or fast casual food restaurants, they use a lot of salt. Meals we looked at in Panera, for example, for their soba noodles, they used 1,000 milligrams of sodium. And the average American should have probably be aiming for around 2,300 milligrams. So that's a problem right there. Their bistro French onion soup had a little over 1,800 milligrams of sodium, and that's 80% of what would be recommended. So no matter where you are, you have to be really careful.
So one thing to avoid is ordering supersize.
Right.
And any other advice for people when they're ordering fast casual food?
Yeah.
Watch out for sodium.
Yeah, watch the sodium. Check the nutrition information. All these places will have it. You may have to ask for it, but you can check and see what the nutrition information is on it. Skip the high-calorie toppings, like if you get a burrito or taco or rice bowl. Don't add a lot of cheese or any cheese. Don't add the sour cream, but you could add some salsa and something like that, which will have a lot less calories. Mm-hmm. They may have a lot of sodium, though. If you have a salad, ask to take, not to put the dressing on it, but have the dressing on the side and use it very sparingly, because the dressing is what adds a lot of calories to that. Order half sizes. In Panera, for example, you could offer they offer half-size paninis, and that only has 300, 350 calories as opposed to 600 to 700 calories. And they often they have what are called secret menus, and you can ask what they're offering at that time. You can often get free veggies as a side, for example, with your taco. So that's helpful. And the last thing we advised was to be careful of the beverages. A lot of these places sell conventional sodas, and they have drinks that may sound really healthy, but they may have just as much sugar as conventional sodas.
You mean those tropical teas and things like that?
Exactly. So those are the places that you can really add on the calories without really knowing it, and they're empty calories. There's no nutritional value.
Let's talk about, for people who cook at home, cookware. Are coatings on pots and pans typically tested for health safety?
No, they're not. The coatings have been really just sort of grandfathered in over time. The coating that we looked at was, it's got a long name, but we'll just call it PTFE, which most people know as Teflon. That was a name given by the DuPont company to this in 1938. And it's pretty clear that if you cook these Teflon-coated pans at a very, very high temperature, usually over 660 degrees, then it starts to vaporize, and you can get what's called Teflon flu. The medical term for that is polymer fume fever, and that reflects in coughing, fever, and feeling pretty miserable, sort of like influenza. But frankly, nobody should get the temperature that high. Mm-hmm. Typically cooking with these pans, you're going to be around 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So that shouldn't be a problem. Where we've seen problems with this is when people leave the pan on the fire and forget about it. And that's when you can get a lot of the vaporized Teflon in the air. One of the other things we were concerned about is that to make this PTFE, in the past, companies were using another long-chained fluorinated compound called PFOAs. And there's some evidence that these PFOAs are carcinogenic to humans. Fortunately, there's very little or no PFOAs that are left in the manufacturing process, and most of these manufacturers are not using it anymore anyway. So that's probably not a problem. The caveat to that is that there are short-chain molecules that have been substituted for PFOAs to do the same thing to produce this Teflon-like coating. And those haven't been studied at all. We have no idea whether they're safe. And that's what's scary. We tend to do things by producing them, using them in the public, and then finding out there's problems afterwards. This is so disconcerting that a group of scientists about a year and a half ago, 220 health professional scientists, signed what's called the Madrid Statement. And what they did was they called on the international community to limit the production of these chemicals until they're demonstrated to be safe. I think a reasonable request.
Well, when you consider how long it takes to get medicines through the FDA and so forth.
Yes.
Heart health, there's been some back and forth over calcium supplements and whether they contribute to better heart health. What does the research tell us about that relationship?
I think the research tells us that the bottom line is not to worry. There were a couple of researchers from New Zealand about 7 years ago who raised this concern. They raised it again in another publication. Since then, there have been a variety of very good studies that have not shown an association between calcium and heart disease. So I think your readers need not worry about that.
Okay. Well, Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks as always for your help today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, All Sides interns Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And you can follow me, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.